At this point, we're going to turn our conversation to our main topic today, free trade in the Middle East. As we mentioned, President Bush has called for a U.S. Middle East free trade zone over the next 10 years. If you'd like to join our conversation on this issue, our phone number again is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. Here is how National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice was speaking last week, how she described the importance of free trade and regional economic growth.
Ultimately, the Middle East needs to have economic and political reforms and an opening of trade that will permit the Middle East to enter the prosperous international community of states from which, unfortunately, it's largely been isolated. And the president really believes that this is one of the keys to a peaceful Middle East. It's not that trade makes peace, but it is that prosperity and trade give people hope. It gives them a desire for a better life. It allows them to concentrate on the things that all people are concerned about, better life for their children, opportunities for their children. And the president's very excited about the Middle East Trade Initiative.
That was National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice last week. Joining us now is Charlene Barshefsky. She was the U.S. Trade Representative during the Clinton administration and served as the nation's chief international trade negotiator from 1997 to 2001. She's with us by phone from her office here in Washington, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good to be here.
It's not an accident the National Security Advisor was commenting on this. What relationship do we see between a Middle East free trade and international security?
Well, we see certainly a pattern, if it were effected in the Middle East, that would be consistent with U.S. trade and economic policy since World War II, and that is that integration among nations, increased economic growth via trade, helps to do two things. It increases overall prosperity, and it helps to cement peace by giving people a stake in what happens across the border in a positive way rather than in a negative way. The two tenets on which modern trade and trade policy are based are these dual notions of prosperity and peace, and the Middle East needs both.
And I'm not going to in any way diminish the difficulties that this will face, and we'll talk about them. But as a ray of hope, if you will, can you describe for us what has happened since the U.S. and Jordan got freer trade just in the last few years?
Well, the Clinton administration looked at the situation in Jordan as one that was at that time rather unique and that merited being recognized. In Jordan, you have a progressive leadership. You have a country that was undertaking on its own very significant economic and structural reform in the mid-90s. It's a country that wanted to join the WTO, wanted to reform its economy, wanted to alter levels of income distribution in the country in a positive way, and that was really on a very progressive path. We captured that in several respects. First off, we created a program between Jordan and Israel to allow goods manufactured jointly by them to come to the U.S. duty-free. This program alone has created about 40,000 Palestinian jobs in the last 4 years. It has been a marvelously successful program. We couple that with helping Jordan to enter the WTO on rapid terms, and we coupled those two initiatives with the negotiation of a free trade agreement with Jordan as a means for it to cement economic reform at home, as a means also to put it on a par with Israel in its trade relations with the U.S. The U.S. and Israel have long had a free trade agreement, and also as a way to spur, over time, Middle East economic integration. That is, over time, a trade agreement between Jordan and Israel and expanding out into the region. So we had many reasons for pursuing Jordan, and we have seen our reasoning in this regard largely vindicated. Jordan has become something of a demonstration for the region, a positive demonstration for the region. Its economy is growing. It is creating jobs in a region that's in desperate need of job creation. It is at peace with Israel, and it is playing, as you know, a very constructive role in the process, roadmap process going on now.
This is a model. Other countries, though, will present much greater difficulties. We'll talk about those when we come back from a short break. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'll also start taking your phone calls and reading some of your emails. TOTN@npr.org is our email address. Don't forget our email challenge. And, of course, our phone number, 800-989-8255. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later on this hour, we'll talk about why the British regard the War of 1812 as just a sideshow of the Napoleonic Wars, and how wars get named. And you can send us your suggestions to name the recent war in Iraq, TOTN@npr.org. Right now, we're continuing our discussion about Middle East trade policy, and you can join that discussion as well by giving us a phone call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, the same, TOTN@npr.org. Our guest is Charlene Barshefsky, former U.S. Trade Representative under President Clinton. And just before the break, we were talking about successes that there has been with Jordan, but that should not take our eyes off the fundamental difficulties that there are going to be to erect a free trade zone in the Middle East.
There's no question that this would be a large undertaking, but I think in some ways talking about a free trade zone really gets ahead of ourselves. Let's first talk a minute about the region. This is a very fragmented region. It is largely isolated from the global economy, despite oil, or to put it another way, oil is the only connection between the Middle East, particularly the Muslim Middle East, and the global economy. This is a region that has among the highest trade barriers in the world, not only to the outside world, but nation against nation in the Muslim Middle East. Not merely the boycott of Israel, but each of these nations trades very, very little with each of the other Muslim nations. It's a region that's heavily commodity dependent, that is to say on oil, resulting in boom and bust cycles. And in being that commodity dependent, the Middle East runs in a direction contrary to every other region in the world, even sub-Saharan Africa, where countries move away from commodity dependency so as to stabilize and diversify their economies. It's a region whose population has doubled since 1980, but its share of global trade has fallen 75%. So this is a region in a state of economic dysfunction, first of all, for the reasons I've outlined within the Muslim Middle East itself, and second, because of the persisting boycott of Israel. Israel should be the region's natural source of investment and technology, much as Singapore was for East Asia, but instead Israel relies on the U.S. and Europe as its trading partners, certainly not its immediate neighborhood, not to the detriment of Israel in particular, but to the detriment of the rest of the region. The question is, what do we do about the state of affairs? The administration has suggested a free trade agreement 10 years from now. First of all, we need programs of a more immediate nature, because it is critical to bring economic and job growth to this region to provide hope and a counterweight to a large, growing, relatively well-educated but unemployed population, subject, of course, as well to radical ideology. Mm-hmm. So we need much more immediate relief, and we need the kind of relief that may help these countries integrate one with the other. And so one possible approach for the short to medium term is something along the lines of what we've done with sub-Saharan Africa, and that is to provide for preferential access to the U.S. market and to the European market for products of the Muslim Middle East, so as to spur economic growth and economic development, or to put into place programs of the nature we have between Jordan and Israel, that is to say cooperative programs among the nations of the Muslim Middle East. Again, products jointly produced would come to the U.S. and to Europe on a preferential basis. On the question of an overall free trade agreement, this, of course, is at least a decade away, and may or may not be what the region is looking for. And I say that because there is great suspicion about U.S. motives, particularly right now, concerns about U.S. either imperialism or mercantilism, which is to say oil. And the question arises further whether relief to this region can, in effect, be delayed for 10 years. I think not. I think there will not be a sustainable peace on political terms without sustainable economic growth.
Well, let's
and
get
that
some,
growth can't wait 10 years.
Let's get some listeners involved. Again, our phone number, 800-989-8255. And Abel joins us from San Diego, California.
Hi. I would like to raise some question to, or I guess raise a counter-argument to the Jordanian thing she was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
People in the Middle East, I'm Middle Eastern. I was born and raised in the U.S., but I've gone there many times. I guess they respond to that as more of a relocation program for the Palestinians rather than an actual solution. And I think it hinders the growth of that because it's basically, it seems like it's kicking out the Palestinians and relocating them to Jordan, if that makes sense. I guess.
Well, that's one specific project that Charlene Barshefsky was talking about, but are there broader questions about the Middle East free trade zone that you have?
Well, yeah, I also think the beliefs and philosophies of the region aren't necessarily the same as the United States. Like, they don't believe in a similar, in a dream like the American dream to become wealthy, to have a happy lifestyle. In that sense, they look for more of a righteous lifestyle, and I think trying to impregnate our values on them is not going to go over very well. I think we have to cater this more towards their lifestyle.
Charlene Barshefsky, particularly on that second point, I was wondering if you could respond.
Well, I think this is a very interesting observation, and it is what I alluded to before, which is to say a free trade agreement with the United States may not be the appropriate answer. I think we don't know enough to know whether it would or not. But certainly, trading among the nations of the Middle East seems to me is definitely one of the answers to this very complex puzzle. That is to say, these countries, putting aside the United States, certainly have to integrate one with another in order to gain economies of scale, in order to benefit from notions of comparative advantage, and in order to create that rising tide, if you will, that tends to lift all boats. And in that, I think that the caller makes a very, very good point, which is to say the U.S. must be careful when we throw around terms like free trade, and of course nothing is free, as we all know.
No.
When we throw around terms like that, that we understand better the countries with whom we're dealing, what their particular ethic or value system is, and then try and work with them to structure programs for economic growth that fit their sensibility, and that are also, therefore, because there's local buy-in, effective.
Okay. Well, Abel, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks a lot.
And Charlene Barshefsky, we appreciate you joining us today.
My pleasure.
Charlene Barshefsky was the U.S. Trade Representative under President Clinton, currently a senior international partner at Wilmer, Cutler & Pickering, and she joined us by phone from here in Washington, D.C. Well, joining us now is Ned Walker. Edward Walker is president of the Middle East Institute, previously served as U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates, and he's also on the phone with us from Washington. Good of you to be back with us on Talk of the Nation.
Yes. Good to be here.
We spoke briefly about the impact of trade policy on security in the Middle East. Do you see any relationship between reducing of trade barriers, you know, sounds like a pretty academic topic, and reducing the threat of global terrorism?
Yes, I think there definitely is. When you've got unemployment rates running at around 20% in many of the Arab countries, it means that young people who are graduating from universities can't get jobs in that society. It means they can't get married. It means they're frustrated, and it tends to lead to radicalization of the younger people in these countries. That some of them, at least in that context, will turn to terrorism. So economic stability, economic opportunity is part and parcel, has got to be a part and parcel of the war on terrorism.
A former Clinton administration official by the name of Edward Gresser, now a trade analyst with the Democratic Progressive Policy Institute, said if the administration is serious about this free trade zone, it ought to begin immediately by lifting tariffs on such Middle East products as olive oil, figs, dates, leather goods, luggage, and clothes to make them cheaper in the United States and to create jobs in the Arab world. Is that something that you would see as a positive step?
Well, you've got to balance out the situation in this country and the people who already produce that kind of article in this country, particularly in the textiles area, and the needs of the region. One of the big problems of the region really is investment capital, and a lot of times they can't compete with other parts of the world simply because the technology is not up to snuff. The manufacturing processes aren't adequate to be competitive. So it's a larger problem than just opening up the door to a few commodities. I think it's got to be hand in glove with substantial and major reforms in these countries to attract investment. And that means foreign investment. That also means you've got to have a legal system where you can be sure that when a contract is let, that you get paid. It means that you've got recourse to the law. It means getting rid of numerous very complicated steps to open businesses. In other words, a general reform process needs to take place in a number of these countries. And they've been slow off the mark to do that.
Let's go now to Toby, who joins us on the line from Boise, Idaho.
Yeah, hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Good. A question that I had is, social scientists have noticed that with the recent trend in globalization, in certain third world countries, there's actually been a widening of the gap between the rich and the poor. This is obviously, as kind of everybody's acknowledging, poverty sometimes is the seed of terrorism. Is the administration addressing the possibility of this happening in the Middle East? And if so, would not terrorism merely get worse?
Yeah, I think that the reality is that the gap has actually increased in the region between the rich and the poor. I do believe that there is a link, although not a direct one, between poverty and terrorism. Most of the terrorists are not impoverished. Most of them are frustrated people who have come from middle class and have some education. So it's not exactly a direct link. It's more a question of whether jobs are available and whether people can feel good about themselves. So I think there is an important message to the administration that they do have to work on this problem of the increasing gap, because that leads to a lot of comparisons and potentially to instability. But just keep in mind, we've got a pretty big gap in this country as well. It may be that the bottom level isn't quite as badly off as some of the bottom levels in these countries in the Middle East. But
Toby, wouldn't the creation of a middle class be the real point that most people say you can't develop a working democracy without a middle class?
I think that's exactly right. And one of the things, though, that has been happening is that in certain third world countries, that middle class is very, very small. Take, for instance, Brazil. Huge separations between massive amounts of poverty and very few with lots of money at the top. And I would just hope that this wouldn't happen, because if this would happen, you would think it would only add fuel to the fire.
Yeah, I think it's already happened, though. I mean, I think you have somewhat the same situation in a country like Egypt, for example. Then you have countries in the Middle East that depend on foreign labor to do the menial jobs, and there the gap is pretty big between the guest workers, so to speak, and the citizens themselves. But in the final analysis, I think if you can't provide jobs for your people, you've got a serious problem, and you're definitely contributing to the instability of the region and the potential for terrorism.
Well, Toby,
okay, good. Thank you very much.
Appreciate the phone call.
Okay.
And Ed Walker, well, it seems like very brief time for you today, but we thank you for it anyway.
Well, always delighted.
Edward Walker is the president of the Middle East Institute. He was with us by phone from his office in Washington, D.C. Don't forget about our email challenge, a name for the conflict which just ended in Iraq. We'll be talking about how wars acquire their names. Later on in the program, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now is Ali Aboutalibi. He's a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire and joins us from the studios of WHWC in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. It's good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you.
I was wondering, get your reaction to the idea that we've been talking about, the president's proposal to encourage freer trade in the Middle East, possibly erecting a U.S. Middle East free trade zone 10 years from now.
Well, free trade, I think, can be positive in the long term, but the problem with the Middle East, really, the problem with low economic development is a political problem. And that is, you have a region which fundamentally has authoritarian but ineffective governments, unable to establish viable institutions, financial institutions, as well as political institutions, enabling society to move toward a more open economic system. So you have the worst case of a bad, ineffective government and weak institutions. And if we do not address those, we cannot adequately talk about prospects for economic change and development, even with free trade. After all, free trade is not so much of an issue. Is the composition of free trade which is more important. Even if you have free trade in about 10 years, the way that we are envisioning it, these societies, these governments don't have much to export, for example, to the West, and they would begin to import more and more from the West. So the nature of trade will be imbalanced. And in terms of compositions, we also have to address the question of what these societies need the most, perhaps more foreign direct investments, investment in technology and education, as opposed to, let's say, importation and investment in food industry or variety of consumption products, et cetera.
But where do you start? I mean, if you're not going to get foreign investment without a more open legal system and a more open political system.
Well, you have to start with the political problems. We are talking about governments which in the post World War II, most of them they're frontier states or the states which depend on the oil income. To basically export oil and bringing the money and in basically wasting it away. If you look at the current, for example, of the level of money invested by these governments in their own societies is a very low level. Mm-hmm. Much of the money generated by oil export is invested in Western countries in pursuit of profits. Also, much of the money which comes to these societies because of oil export is filtered down to society through governments. And there you have the problem with corruption, lack of transparency, etc.
Well, we're going to take a short break now, and when we come back, we'll let the professor answer a couple of your calls and emails. Our number again is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Again, don't forget the email challenge. We're looking for a name for the conflict which just ended in Iraq, totn@npr.org. An Iraqi exile group is defending itself against accusations of misleading the Bush administration about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. The Iraqi National Congress says growing discoveries of atrocities committed in Saddam Hussein's Iraq justified the U.S.-led war. Also, more on President Bush's meeting today in Egypt with moderate Arab leaders to win support for the new roadmap to peace between Israel and the Palestinians. Those stories later today on All Things Considered. We're back on Talk of the Nation in just a couple of minutes. I'm Neil Conan. This is NPR News. Right now, we're discussing the idea of a Middle East free trade zone, or at least freer trade in the Middle East, between the Middle Eastern countries and the United States. Our guest right now is Ali Aboutalibi, a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire. And let's go get some more callers involved. James joins us on the line from Hoboken, New Jersey.
Yeah, hi, Neil. Hello, Professor. I've been concerned with liberalization and economics for some time, and my concern had to do with, I guess, the type and the pace of liberalization. Some people have written that rapid liberalization has often led to destitution, particularly in Russia and East Asia. And that also that economics doesn't deal with some of the underlying issues, like health and welfare, particularly education, that's really behind what a lot of the miracle economies in the developing world are about. And I was wondering what you thought about that, whether there are real issues about rapid liberalization and that policies implemented by the West, say via the IMF, are typically ruinous to developing countries because they're simply too rapid, and they allow for rapid influxes and, I guess, removal of capital.
Now, Professor Abu Talabi?
Yes, well, I think the caller has good points that needs further discussion. The problem, of course, in this society is that the level of subsidies is rather high because governments must keep the price of, for example, fuel and food, etc., down. And also, government has big hand in the economy altogether. So overall, we can say that that privatization and removal of some of the subsidies in conjunction with free trade can bring more competition and perhaps a better and more efficient economies. But in the meanwhile, we have to be careful because, you know, as in previous occasions, for example, the rise in price of fuel or bread had led to riots and demonstrations on the streets. So when we talk about liberalization, we have to talk about a very slow process of making the economy more competitive through removal of subsidies, but not to the extent that government totally withdraw from economy and society.
Just let me ask, Professor, though, as we keep reading in the statistics that the Arab countries in particular are falling further and further behind on issues like investment you talked about a moment ago. The entire Middle Eastern world, excluding, I think, Turkey and Israel, got the combined investment that was received in Sweden this past year. I mean, they're just going to fall further and further behind. Slow doesn't seem to be a recipe for catching up.
Well, you're on that point. In most of society,
there's something that Stiglitz writes about that very often it needs to be controlled and paced. If you don't control it, if you simply remove subsidies, you'll get rioting in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it becomes, like somebody had mentioned before, a hotbed for terrorism.
It's not now?
Well, it can get worse. If the U.S. comes in and then starts to create problems with the government and the economy by pushing for rapid liberalization without welfare for the people, there can be an even stronger backlash in terms of terrorism.
Well, the U.S. is blamed for the inequities now, but go ahead, Professor Abu Talabi.
Yeah, let me go to a point I mentioned earlier. In the region, you have governments which are basically ineffective and inefficient in promoting economic growth. This is contrary to the case of Singapore, perhaps, which was mentioned earlier, or in East Asia altogether, where government, although very, very centralized in terms of power, was also effective in promotion of export-led industrialization. In this society, this is not the case. On the other hand, totally open societies, open free market is not the remedy. What we need is more effective governments, and for that to occur, we have to go back to political reform. We need the establishment of popular-based democracies in the region. We need the establishment of institutions in the region. You know, in most of these countries, you cannot have an organized labor. Labor unions are illegal. Political parties do not exist, or if they do, they are basically rubber stamp of the executive branch. In that atmosphere, you cannot really promote economic development. To make things worse, even in these societies, we have old traditional coalition and alliances between small businesses, traditional clerics, and perhaps feudal lords or landlords and tribal leadership, who are extremely resistant to the quest to the point of opening their economies, because they are very comfortable, and they have been comfortable for centuries with the socioeconomic setup that they have had. You know, it's no wonder when you go to anywhere in the region, you see hundreds of thousands of small shop owners who are very powerful in their connection with the government to try to maintain the status quo. So when we talk about free trade, it is looked upon by many, especially the old traditional alliances and coalitions, in a very suspicious manner. Free trade would translate into increased consumption in society, cultural imperialism, and importation of Western ideas and products, and basically undermining our own local culture. So as you can see, it's a very complex situation. I'm not arguing that free trade is not a good thing, but we have to really be careful about what we mean by free trade, the composition of trade, and the consequences of free trade. Otherwise, we are missing the boat.
Professor Abu Talabi, thank you very much today.
My pleasure.
Ali Abu Talabi, I'll get it right. Let's get it right all the way through. Ali Abu Talabi is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire.